This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, back from our, it was a combined business trip and our 35th wedding anniversary. We burned through some frequent flyer miles that were about to expire at the end of the month. Do you need to buy carbon offsets when you're using frequent flyer miles? I don't know. I think our carbon offsets cover pretty much all of my flying, but anyhow, an interesting question. I would say yes would be the answer. In any case, we're back. We had a great time in London, and I want to share with you in the third hour of our program some of the just absolutely fascinating points of view that we got out of the UK, that, you know, things that we heard and saw and what was in the press and whatnot, particularly about American politics, just some truly remarkable stuff. Some truly remarkable stuff. And we will get into what happened in Nevada and what's going on in South Carolina and just, you know, politics in general in just a few minutes. One of the biggest dimensions of politics in general is the healthcare issue. The healthcare issue, frankly, in my opinion, certainly on the Democratic side, but frankly, I think even across the board, right across the board, is going to be the issue. If not Iraq, but it's going to be one of the main, and if we're not in the middle of a Great Depression, today the markets are closed at being Martin Luther King, the Martin Luther King holiday. His actual birthday was last Wednesday, but today is Martin Luther King Day. And so we're not going to see what happened in America, but markets all around the world crashing, and at least according to the Financial Times and other business media, because they're concerned that 26 years of Reaganomics and Milton Friedman and Thomas Friedman economics have destroyed the infrastructure of America, just like the Republicans did in the teens and 20s. And, you know, Calvin Coolidge and Warren Harding leading right up to the Republican Great Depression. So anyhow, but nonetheless, whether that's the top issue or whether it's healthcare is a big one. And Alex Epstein is with us. Alex is a junior fellow with the Ayn Rand Institute. These are the folks who are the holders of the flame of objectivism. Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, the major work that led to objectivism, which then led to, not with the efforts of Alex and company, but nonetheless then led to the Libertarian Party, libertarianism and the libertarian strain within the Republican Party, and all things Ron Paul. But not here to speak on behalf of them, merely on behalf of the purists among the Randians. AynRand.org, AynRand.org, the website. Alex Epstein. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here. Definitely not here to speak on behalf of the pacifist anti-self-defense Ron Paul.
Oh, really? You disagree with his pacifist point, his anti-Iraq war point of view? Because he's openly in favor of World War II. He's not a pacifist.
Well, yeah, we'd have to go into that. And unfortunately, I work for a 501c3, so as much as I would like to comment extensively on political candidates, I'm not legally allowed to.
Oh, you're right. It would have to be a 501c4, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. Well, okay, Boston Mayor, this is from the news release that you guys sent out, or the article that you sent out. Boston Mayor Thomas M. Mino declared that this decision to have the Massachusetts Public Health Council allow CVS, the drugstore chain, and other drugstore chains, operate small, you know, walk-in clinics. Hey, I've got a hangnail. Hey, my finger's cut. I need stitches. Would you look at my eyes? My eyes all red. Whatever it may be. That, you know, you're saying that they're concerned that it jeopardizes patient safety. His actual quote that you quoted is that it, quote, jeopardizes patient safety. Limited service medical clinics run by merchants in for-profit corporations will seriously compromise quality and hygiene. And then I have the actual quote from the newspaper here. I'm looking at the paper. Massachusetts says, allowing retailers to make money off sick people is wrong. People need continuous care, and this type of for-profit facility is ignoring the standards and measures needed for quality care. Yet you think this is just a marvelous thing.
Yet I think what is a marvelous thing?
that these doc-in-the-box clinics are popping up in pharmacies and restaurants and who knows what all around the country?
Well, I mean, I don't have a specific opinion on all of these things. I think that certainly there should be a free market in the provision of medical services, and that there's a lot of things that the government does to create a monopoly for various procedures, like only allowing doctors to treat certain things where nurse practitioners could, which, you know, does the same thing as any other kind of monopoly, which is it restricts competition. I mean,
so you'd rather have the guy next door to you who has cut up a few cats like Bill Frist did when he was a teenager doing surgery on you?
No, I would check out people's credentials, but there's no reason why for various small medical procedures something like this couldn't be legitimate. But I think the most important part of this quote is this idea that making money off sick people is wrong, which is a common sentiment that we hear, especially with regard to the pharmaceutical industry, which they put profits over people, or they profit off of sickness. And this is a really corrupt view. Because the truth is that there are unlimited needs in human life. And under a capitalist system,
Wait a second, There are not unlimited needs. There may be unlimited wants.
Let's take the needs first, and then we can deal with what you would call wants, and I would say would fall under certain needs like happiness. But if you have there are needs, food, clothing, shelter, medicine, and then all kinds of social, recreational, happiness, relaxation, all kinds of things like that. And in a free society, people can produce values that then satisfy those needs, and we pay them to do that. So what a person who creates a pharmaceutical does is he does not profit off of sickness. He profits off of curing sickness, just like the people who put on the entertaining NFL.
Then why is it that the big pharmaceutical companies are being...
By helping me enjoy myself.
Sure, I understand. But then why is it that the pharmaceutical companies right now in Europe are being attacked for monopolistic activities, for rolling over patents in phony ways so that they can maintain their profits?
Well,
if they're just in it to make us healthy, you'd think that they would just allow us to be healthy and have a reasonably priced pharmaceutical. Instead, they're the second most profitable industry in the world.
Well, you regard being profitable as a black mark. I regard that as evidence of producing great value.
No, I don't see it as a black mark. What I'm saying is that they're putting profits above the well-being of their customers.
They are the ones who create the product that makes that even well-being conceivable. So if they create a new drug...
Well, in point of fact, actually, most drugs are created by government-financed university research in the United States and then, you know, refined or brought to market by for-profit corporations.
Well, in point of fact, the pharmaceutical
and that's
market
not the
definitely
free market.
Invests a lot more than the government does, but I'm
not absolutely... in the original research. In the marketing, they invest more, and in the trials, they invest more. But in the original research, you and I are paying for that out of our tax dollars.
Okay, and especially the rich people who you think don't have nearly enough taxes taken away from them. Those are the people who are paying for it most, including the pharmaceutical company. So I'm absolutely in favor of getting rid of the government research apparatus and having the pharmaceutical companies finance that themselves. Now, that might make drugs a little bit more the cost might show up in the price of drugs, but that's fine with me. The point is, these guys are providing a life-saving product.
You know, the bottom line here, well, back to these clinics, though. I have no problem with there being clinics all over the place. When I was in the UK a couple of years ago and our daughter got sick, we walked a block and a half to a clinic. I mean, they have, in every neighborhood, they call them local surgeries. It's basically a local doctor's office. You can walk in off the street. When Louise and I were there last weekend, we stayed, you know, we were two blocks away from a hospital. I mean, healthcare is ubiquitous. It's easy. It's available. And it's free. You have a problem with that, I mean, ultimately. And my suggestion is that's fine if CVS and Walmart and whatnot want to have doc-in-the-box clinics in their facilities. Let's just bring this under the rubric of Medicare for all. Let's make it free. Why pay $56?
What is free? I mean, free just means that, I mean, free in your definition just means that taxpayers pay for it, and then they have absolutely no control.
Right, free like our roads, free like our police services, free like our fire services. We pay for it with our taxes, and we use it irregardless of how much we use it. It's available to all of us on the same basis. That's what I call free.
Right, yeah. I mean, there are many.
Our socialized roads, our socialized, you know, schools, our socialized.
Right. Well, I believe that the only thing that, first of all, they're not free. I mean, you pay for them. Now, police service is a very defined function that's actually part of what a government's supposed to do, which is protect your rights from other people coercing you with medicine. What it does.
So you're in favor of some socialism?
It's not socialism. It's the precondition of allowing freedom of individual action. But what?
Well, how is staying alive not a precondition?
You're in favor of taking away my freedom to decide how to take care of my life by taking away all my money and shunting me into some sort of British disastrous health care system. And I'm completely against that.
Okay. Alex Epstein, you can read all about it at Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org, the website. Thanks a lot for being with us today, Alex.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
This here's a land of plenty, and plenty's what it takes to get some health insurance in these old United States. I just know I shouldn't have to go bankrupt or on the street if the cancer comes a-calling, as it might for you or me. I ran into my congressman, said, "Your Honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes, if you ever find the time, to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C. So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way to keep you upright till the good Lord says that it's your day." Hey.
Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, Hillary Clinton wins the Nevada caucuses. Question is, why did Barack Obama get more delegates? Is that how it worked out? Yeah, one more delegate? I guess, you know, apparently they have a system there that is weighted toward the rural areas in a particular way. And, you know, they just think it's fairer that way. Bottom line, they're both up there. So, anyhow, Hillary Clinton winning the Nevada caucuses. And John McCain, finally, the people of South Carolina realizing that the push polls in 2000 against him, run by the Bush campaign, were lies. In the midst of all this, when Louise and I were over in London over the weekend, we got home last night about 12 hours ago, this very minute. And the newspaper, I mean, it's so funny. It's just you know, heading out of the hotel on our way to the airport. You know, 6 o'clock in the morning, we're heading out to the airport, and they've got the newspapers at the hotel. And this is a nice hotel. You know, it wasn't the Ritz, but you know, it was a decent hotel. And so I grabbed the paper off the stand, and we're reading the paper in the cab. And flip to page 16. This is the Independent. And there's a half-page picture of George Bush waving goodbye. And the headline, I just have to share this with you. I mean, this is the British perspective. The headline says, "Just one more year!" Exclamation mark. The subhead, now that's like in maybe 60-point type, almost an inch tall. The subhead, in what's probably 48-point type, but you know, a good 3/8 of an inch tall. "Good riddance to George W. Bush." And then the smaller subhead below that, which is probably in 16-point type, you know, about twice the size of regular reading typography, says, "But what kind of mess will the next president inherit exactly 12 months from today?" By Rupert Cornwall in Washington. And then the article begins, right? "Is he the worst president in U.S. history? Mr. Bush faces stiff competition from the likes of James Buchanan, who watched as America slipped toward civil war, or Warren Harding with his corrupt administration, or Herbert Hoover, who failed to halt the slide into the Great Depression, or more recently Richard Nixon, the only president to be forced to resign. But in terms of dogmatism, incompetence, ignorance, and divisiveness, Mr. Bush surely compares with any of the above. In Greek mythology, Hercules washed away that mess by rerouting the rivers Alpheus and Phineas, or Peneus. Whoever takes the oath of office on next January the 20th will face a similar task in repairing America, both at home and in the eyes of the world." I would guess that the British sort of have a take on George Bush. at least this newspaper does. And then they have this great chart on page 17, how the candidates would change America. Under the economy, Hillary Clinton has proposed a $70 billion emergency stimulus package aimed at lowering income groups. Barack Obama wants immediate tax cuts for workers, homeowners, and retirees. John Edwards would beef up federal aid to the states and bolster investment in clean energy, repeal the Bush tax cuts, and raise capital gains to 28%. John McCain. I'm quoting from the newspaper. This is not the editorial section. This is the news. John McCain. Like most Republicans, he hasn't got into the specifics of an anti-recession package. Like them, he would make Bush's tax cuts permanent instead of letting them expire in 2010. Mike Huckabee. Peddles a weird conservative populism. Mitt Romney. Promises a stimulus package, but no details so far. Under health care. Barack Obama, proposals far less comprehensive than those of Clinton and Edwards. John Edwards, the first to propose a detailed plan for universal coverage. Hillary Clinton, healthcare reform was her nemesis in 2004, now proposes a plan requiring everybody get insurance through employers. Mike Huckabee, insists on a free market system. Mitt Romney, insists healthcare coverage should be a matter of choice, with the cost tax deductible. But, as Massachusetts governor, he pushed a plan virtually the same as those of Clinton and Edwards. And under immigration, on Mitt Romney, he says, turned super right wing on immigration. It's like, but what's interesting is they've got this graph, and they show that John McCain beats all of the Democrats. Beats Obama by 1 point, beats Edwards by 2 points, beats Clinton by 4 points. On the other hand, Obama, Edwards, and Clinton beat all of the Republicans. Obama by the highest percentages, Edwards by the second highest percentages, and Clinton by the third highest percentages. Very, very nice, very interesting analysis, you know, of combining a half a dozen different polls, to tell the Brits, you know, what's up. So interesting time. It was interesting to see America from another perspective. And, of course, when we first arrived, our plane was the last plane to land before the plane crashed. We had absolutely nobody in front of us. The airport was empty when we went through security. Got in a taxi, and all the way to the hotel, a taxi driver was going off about how the government killed Princess Diana. Amazing. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Just a couple other newsy things, as it were, that I want to get through here before we get to, before we pick up your phone calls. Safeway also is going to be picking up this program. This is particularly interesting. This again from the Financial Times. U.S. shoppers could find their health insurance premiums being linked to their food buying habits if an innovative initiative by a leading supermarket wins acceptance. Now, on the surface, this sounds like, gee, a supermarket wants to help us with our health. I think it's a supermarket wants to get more personal information about you and me, because they're tying this to their frequent buyer program. Safeway, which operates over 1,700 supermarkets across the country, says its plans to offer its employees discounts on their health insurance if they participate in a service that tracks the nutritional quality of food they buy at stores. Safeway's proposals would be linked to the retailer's online Food Flex service, launched in November as an offshoot of its loyalty card program. So not only do you have to buy food from your employer, but you have to be part of their program in order to get a discount on your health care? System uses the information on their Safeway card to deliver a nutritional analysis of their purchases at the store. Mr. Bird said that while some of the initiatives could be considered intrusive, the retailer is following the principles established in motor insurance. Yeah, well, you know, it's not intrusive. See, with car insurance, they just check your credit ratings to decide how to set your price, which I think is wrong, too. Okay, here's another one. This drug demand threatens vital medicinal plants. I mean, this is a genuine and serious problem. I mean, this requires our Jaws music here. Habitat destruction and the increasing demand for drugs are threatening to wipe out some of the world's most important medicinal plant species and could spark a global healthcare crisis. Survey carried out by more than 100 botanists and other scientists found that more than 10,000 species of medicinal plants face extinction, including many commonly used in prescription drugs. Quoting Belinda Hawkins, the author of the report by the Botanic Gardens Conservation International, UK-based charity, up to 15,000 medicinal plants are under threat in the wild, and if no action is taken, 10,000 could be extinct in under 10 years. As many as 50% of prescription drugs are now based on a molecule that occurs naturally in a plant. They use the example of Taxol. Paxilitixel is the name of it. Comes from the yew tree. And the yew has all but defied all attempts of commercial synthesis. An average of 6 trees are needed for just a single dose. Its use has decimated wild yew populations across the world, with 80% of the trees in China's Yunnan province, once famous for its yew forests, destroyed within just the last 3 years. In the U.S., 70% of all newly developed drugs are derived from natural sources. And we're going to destroy them. And is the EPA going to do anything about this? Is anybody going to do anything? Nah. And, yeah. And, well, there's a few other things here I want to get into. Nationalization coming back in the U.K. New Zealand has nationalized their airline. Russia has nationalized their oil, gas, natural resources. Mexico, Scandinavian countries, Asian countries like Indonesia have nationalized some of their banks. Our banks, frankly, are being nationalized, and our investment companies. It's just that they're not being nationalized by us. Instead of being nationalized by the United States, they're being nationalized by Singapore, Saudi Arabia, China, Dubai, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi. So, anyway, that's I got to tell you about what's going on with Nokia, but I will in a little bit. We'll get to that. We have 3 hours here, 38 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Alan in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Alan, you were at the Nevada caucuses?
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, I was there for John Edwards, and basically there's must have been in the precinct area we were at, we broke up. Must have been about 70 for Hillary, 40 for Barack, and then the five of us, including, and then six, including the precinct captain for Edwards.
And do you think that what hurt John Edwards so much in the two things that I've heard, and just in the news media, I obviously was not in Nevada, are, number one, that he didn't campaign in Nevada. He didn't run any money. He didn't run any ads. He basically chose to sit that one out. And, and number two, he had voted for Yucca Mountain way back when.
But, you know, it's funny because he had actually atoned for it. I guess he had said that he was against it now, but at the time he didn't know, and I understand that. And it's interesting because, yeah, I mean, we didn't see, being living out here in Vegas, there was no commercials for Edwards at all.
Yeah.
We were getting played to the hilt of Hillary and then finally Obama. I mean, I was on the radio and the only thing you can get out here is right wing on, there's no left wing at all. I gotta catch you on cable. But it's that whole thing where,
Actually, we're on the air in Reno, and in fact, I'll be out there in a couple of weeks. But you're in Las Vegas, so you probably can't get that. Yeah.
And as much union as there is out here, it surprised me because, I mean, I was reading in the only good decent paper out here. It's a libertarian paper, the Review Journal, and that paper was basically talking about Edwards did have some support from like the carpenters and some of the smaller labor work unions, but it surprises me. I want to know where all these right-wing Republicans are at because we don't see them. Everybody I've ever talked to has always been to the left.
Yeah.
Hillary is just, to me, just her people that was, I mean, it broke down to the right demographic. Most of the people that were on the Hillary end were all, 65-plus crowd or people that didn't know a whole lot is what it came back to. I mean, somebody actually looked at me when I said, well, you know, Hillary took money from Rupert Murdoch, and they're like, no, that's false. Well, no, it's not. And Obama had supported Lieberman when he was trying to keep his job instead of Ned Lamont.
Right. Yeah, so I have also read that, by and large, the Hispanic vote went for Barack Obama, the African-American vote went for Hillary, that was a significant factor. On the Republican side, that there are correct me on that, and also on the Republican side, that there are a lot of Mormons in that state. Harry Reid is a Mormon, and thus Mitt Romney.
Yeah, I know, but isn't Harry Reid, he's also a Mormon, isn't he?
Yeah, that was my point.
But yet, he's on our side, the good side.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the one thing I did notice, I talked to a few people on the Obama side, and they were saying if Obama wasn't running, about at least 90% of these people would be for Edwards. And the problem is, yeah, we didn't see any commercials, hear anything. anything on
well,
John
Edwards. he's not bundling money from the big financial services companies and the big oil companies and whatnot. He's not taking the PAC and the other contributions that Hillary is. He doesn't have the hundreds of millions or over $100 million that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton do, and so he's having
or even Romney.
Romney's writing a lot of these checks out of his own pocket, you know.
Yeah,
that's the big untold story of this campaign.
Yeah, the sad part was, I don't know, I know you don't have cable yourself, but Showtime, they actually have that show, Penn and Teller BS, and I had actually watched this the night before going to the caucus, and one of the things was that they were Penn and Teller were both arguing why Yucca Mountain is good and why nuclear energy is good, and it's great until you figure out how the hell you're going to store the spent uranium.
Yeah. Yeah, and then it becomes a problem. Alan, thanks a lot for the heads up. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. Maureen in the west coast of France calling in. Hey, Maureen.
Hi, good to talk to you again. I don't really want to change the subject from John Edwards, who is getting good press over here, but I wanted to make a comment on what your Ayn Randian guest at the beginning of the show said about the disastrous health system in England. Well, it's not that bad, actually, but how come nobody looks at the French system, because it's consistently rated number one in all of the world?
Well, that's why they don't look at it here.
Yeah,
that's why nobody talks about it here, other than Michael Moore.
Right. I finally saw the DVD last night. I mean, he did a great job, Michael Moore, explaining what goes on here in France. It's the best system in the world.
Yeah. Well, so. Thank you. And you're happy with it, Maureen.
Oh, yeah, really.
Are you an American living in France, or are you French?
Yeah, I'm a dual national, right. I've raised children in France, and it's been great.
Great.
It's been great. But I wanted to mention also the Yucca Mountain subject. The French, of course, are number one in the... the recycling of the
nuclear
waste on the west coast of France up north near Normandy. And actually the waste comes from all over the world, and they don't stock it. They recycle it and they deactivate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've...
Everybody knows they make the best reactors, nuclear reactors in the world. So why doesn't anybody talk about that either?
They seem to have figured out that technology.
They have. They do the best technological
I'd like to learn more about that. Maureen, thanks a lot for the call.
Okay,
and
thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening there in Europe. Jake in Eureka, California. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Just great.
You know, often what you hear from the Clinton campaign is that, you know, a reason to vote for Hillary is her experience with healthcare. You know, her bad experience, the fact that she mishandled and bungled the entire healthcare initiative. Let's be honest about what happened back in the 90s. You know, that is a big part of the reason why the Republicans took control of the Congress, is the way the Clintons mishandled healthcare, and in large part due to Hillary Clinton's personality. I mean, just the simple fact that you have about half the country that say they will never vote for Hillary under any circumstances is reason enough to nominate Barack Obama, in my opinion, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I don't disagree with you. I think that there is a very, very strong anti-Hillary vote out there. And as the earlier caller said, you know, a lot of folks who were voting for Barack Obama said, you know, if he wasn't there, they'd be voting for John Edwards. I suspect if neither one of them were there and it was, Bill Richardson, they'd be voting for him. I mean, there's a strong anti-Hillary vote out there, both in the Democratic Party and right across the board, that has to be contended with, and Hillary has to deal with that. And frankly, I think she's starting to do a good job of it. She's starting to get out there. My problem, frankly, with the way that she did health care back, you know, when her husband was president, the way that she was helping cheerlead that, was that it wasn't really universal health care. It was, you know, let's make it more profitable for the health insurance companies. Let's bring them in. It was too wishy-washy. And that's why I think it never really caught fire with the American people. And then, of course, you had, you know, the health insurance industry spending hundreds of millions of dollars on television ads that essentially lied about the program and what they were doing. And thus, you got what you got. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Speaking of a 5 o'clock world, Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans.
Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Brought to you also by the sponsors you hear during our breaks, both local and national. Please let them know that you're listening. And buy their products when appropriate, when and where appropriate. 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And Christopher in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Christopher.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What happened?
That's your line.
What happened over the weekend?
Well, listen, a couple of things. First of all, the idea, the whole thing that gentleman, previous caller, talked about Hillary, you know, and her personality ruining the healthcare issue. I think the point you made about how many tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, the healthcare and pharmaceutical and medical industry spent
My recollection is it was $300 million, but I may be wrong. I mean, it's been a decade, but that's my recollection.
I've heard 260, $260 was the number I heard. So anyway, the point is they spent so much money to beat her up that it wasn't her issue at all. I mean, come on, guys misguided. Anyway, I helped assist a lady named Cindy Trigg here in the rurals of northern Nevada who was hired by the National Party to organize the rurals. And it was
for the caucuses.
I'm sorry?
The caucuses you're talking about.
Yeah, the rural Democratic Party in order to make caucuses happen. I mean, the party has not been established in this state for, 15, 20 years. I mean, solidly. Mm-hmm. There aren't central committees. There isn't really much of an organization. And we had to go out really and level the ground and, in order to build foundations, dig the holes and everything. There really wasn't a lot going on. And she was just amazing. She must have put 10,000 miles in her car in the last 6 months doing it. I helped her do that through the telephone, and I went out personally with her on a lot of runs. And, people in rural Nevada tend to be middle right, if anything. And, the poverty's pretty heavy because the federal government owns like 97% of all land, so there's no taxable tax base for them to work off of, except from the mining industry. Anyway, I want to talk about what happened at my precinct here, and I live in an area called Johnson Lane, which is a little south of Carson City. It was fantastic. There were we got 128 out of something like 230 Democratic registered voters, and there, just to give you an idea, there are over 400 registered Republicans, so it's generally 2-1 in northern Nevada.
Right, and you had half the registered Democrats out to participate in the caucus. How did it break out? How did it happen? How did it work?
Well, a lot of people took offense to it, but I felt like it was, it's the grassroots and it's the Democratic Party herding cats and hummingbirds, and the Obama people were really aggressive. And the rules state that, they have to stay off the floor, they have to stay in their designated areas and with the press and yada, yada. But, they were out there lobbying pretty heavy. And Hillary's people were a little more calm, at least in the four precincts that we were in a multi-purpose room in an elementary school. And there were four precincts, and I'd say there were 500 people there easily. It was really amazing. We ran out of everything. We didn't have ballots. We were using pieces of paper and... you couldn't hear. There weren't PA systems. You can imagine the chaos. We were divided up into four groups, which subdivided into four or five candidate groups. And I mean, it was pretty amazing. And my point is, I think that there is a lot of complaining, but I think at the grassroots party level, that's what you have. We're the great unwashed. We have to organize ourselves.
Your sense of it is that the party worked, the system worked. I'm wondering how it broke out. Hillary, Obama, Edwards.
Well, in my precinct, it was about Hillary and Obama were within, 7 or 8 votes of each other, or 7 or 8
points.
People of each other.
People.
What do you call them? Caucus-eye? I don't know. Anyway, and Edwards had probably about, I think he was sitting somewhere around 20 or 25, and Hillary and Barack were 50 to 55. So... I've seen all the
What candidates. Do you attribute that to? What do you think caused him to do poorly? And by the way, in my last segment, I made some remark about he doesn't have people out there bundling money. He does have people bundling money for him. I shouldn't just paint
well,
everybody.
Well, people point to a lot of these things, but I think, as negatives, but you know, I think you do what you have to do. And, and I think that those guys, he did rally the youth. There were a lot more youth on his side. And,
who's the he you're talking about here?
Pardon me?
Who's the he you're talking about?
Obama, I'm sorry.
Obama, okay.
And I think, you know, I think what hurt Edwards is the fact that he just didn't spend time and money here. I mean, I saw him up in Reno just before the election and or the caucuses. And there was a big crowd. I mean, I'd say, you know, 1,500, 2,000 people. It was big. So there, you know, there was enthusiasm for Edwards because he speaks the most eloquently for progressive values of all the candidates.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the most obviously progressive outside of Dennis Kucinich.
But he didn't campaign in the state. Christopher, thank you for your feedback. I got to move along here, but I appreciate the call. Thank you very much. David in Las Vegas. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. Finally get a chance to talk to you. Thanks to having Martin Luther King off.
Yeah.
Nice to listen to you. I did something. I took care of a loophole here in Vegas where the Republican side, you have to register within 30 days to vote for the caucus. So I tried to vote for Ron Paul. He didn't get the 15%, so I went uncommitted there. And then I registered as a Democrat and tried to vote for John Edwards. And once again, just like everybody else said, Edwards got like very minimal support. And I thought about, given my support to Obama during doing the second go-around, but I challenged the captain of the Obama team here. Ah, darn it, I had a good joke here. I'm going to miss it.
You got 20, you got 10, 15 seconds here, David, if you want to take a shot.
I'm not going to be able to fix it there. But, the support for Hillary and Obama is just people basically not knowing what the issues are. It's just a popularity contest, and it's really upsetting.
Yeah, I think you're right, David. And a lot of media and a lot of money. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Stocks all over the world crashing and burning. This after Mr. Bernanke. They actually resurrected Alan Greenspan. I mean, dug him out of his wherever it is he sleeps during the day. Coffin underground or something. Brought him out. Maybe they avoided the daylight. I don't. I mean, this is really Greenspan's fault. Let's just call it what it is. Alan Greenspan has been advocating. First of all, he was initiated into Ayn Rand's cult back in, I think it was 1956, as I recall, in New York City, in her apartment. He has never left. He has always identified himself as an objectivist, as an uber libertarian, and pursued those policies as Fed chairman. We saw the craze for deregulation really began during the later years of the Carter administration. See, the problem that they were facing in the late 70s was that the Vietnam War, and this, by the way, was very much like the mid-50s. You have a war. You borrow money to spend to pay for the war. Now, here's the problem. If you borrow money to build schools, that money's going to come back into the economy. It's going to come back into the economy tenfold, a hundredfold, however, because those schools are going to produce productive adults. If you borrow money to, as FDR did before the war began, if you borrow money to build infrastructure, to build dams, to build power plants, to build roads, to build schools, to plant forests, to create national monuments that are going to draw tourists, to electrify the rural parts of the United States, to provide telephone service to people in remote areas where corporations refuse to do it because it's not profitable. If you borrow money to do that, that is going to generate enough economic activity that you can pay back the borrowed money with the increased taxes on that increased economic activity. You with me on this? I mean, this is pretty straightforward stuff. If, on the other hand, you borrow money to build bombs
and fighter aircraft and tanks and uniforms for soldiers and bullets. That stuff gets used once and thrown away or blown up. You drop a bomb on somebody, it's not going to generate any economic activity. This is why Republicans who say that what got FDR out of the Great Depression was World War II are so wrong. World War II prolonged the damage that had been done to the United States by the Republican Great Depression and by the deregulation of the Coolidge and Harding administrations that preceded it and that caused it, that directly caused it. So you had all this massive deregulation that happened before 1929. It led to a towering pillar of wealth. And on top of that, we were still having to borrow, pay off money that we had borrowed to fight World War I. Boom, the Great Depression happened. Then you had Vietnam. We slowly dug our way out of that. Then, well, let's just go through it chronologically. Then came World War II. Now, Franklin Roosevelt was pulling us out of the recession, out of the depression, into arguably what by the mid-40s was, or the mid-30s, late 30s, early 40s, was arguably no longer the depression. It was a recession. I mean, unemployment was down from the high of, I think, 33 or 35%. By things like the WPA and regulation of banking industries and regulation of business, basically, and encouraging small business and building infrastructure and rebuilding America. But then he had to go fight World War II, and everything came to a screeching halt, and all this money got borrowed to pay for World War II. Well, that money had to be paid back. Usually you borrow money on 10, 15, 20-year bonds, so that money had to be paid back in the 1950s. Now, I was born in 51, and I remember those years around 54, 55, 56, 57. We moved from one house to another in Lansing, Michigan. We were a family of three living in a one-bedroom house in 55, and in 56 we moved to a three-bedroom house, and we became a family of six. I have three younger brothers. But I remember that time. I remember my dad... before he finally got a job at the tool and die shop, he was selling Rexairs during the daytime, vacuum cleaners door-to-door. He was selling World Book Encyclopedias door-to-door. And he was working at night. He was working the night shift in a drop forge. And so he was working three jobs. I mean, that's the economy was pretty soft in the mid-50s. And, again, it was because we were having to pay off the debt from World War II. We were having to pay off all that money that we had dropped in bombs on Germany and Japan and other places around the world. So we finally got through that. In the 1960s, things really started to boom. You saw the result. You saw the fruit of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. And the war expenses had been kind of wrung out. And what comes along? But, you know, Lyndon Johnson gets us into Vietnam. He's got to make a stand against communism somewhere. He didn't want to do it in Cuba. At that point, he thought that, frankly, Fidel Castro had assassinated Kennedy. He wasn't going to go anywhere near Cuba. So I'm going to make my stand against communism in Vietnam. It's far enough away they can't get us. And so we had the Vietnam War. Well, by the 70s, by the time Jimmy Carter was president, the Vietnam War was over. It ended under Jerry Ford's administration before that. But the bill was coming due. And again, all that money had been borrowed and spent for something that was not productive. I mean, it was very profitable for the war contractors, but it wasn't productive for the United States. It didn't help the U.S. economy. And so Carter was dealing with inflation because the dollar was being inflated so we could pay off currency. We could pay off debts with money that was worth less. And unemployment because the infrastructure hadn't been built. The basis for economic activity hadn't been built. Instead, all this money had gone into Vietnam. So that kind of rung out during the Carter administration. It peaked, I'd say, the year or so before Reagan became president. We had, 16, 17% prime interest rates? I mean, it was a mess. And then Reagan came into power, and he started borrowing money and spending it again for military things that you'd never see a result from. And Reagan did, and Bush Sr. did. And Clinton cut that down somewhat, but then Bush Jr. starts this war in Iraq. And so now we've got another war and another 20 years of massive military spending that's going to absolutely produce nothing for the economy that we're having to pay for. And so what's the predictable result? The predictable result is twofold. Number one, there's a third thing before I get to that. There's a third thing that we can throw in here. And that is that Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr., all four of them, were gung-ho on something that we had never done before in the United States in 200 years, which is throwing our borders open to transnational corporations and saying, if you want to move your jobs overseas, that's fine. We'll even give you a tax break. We don't need no stinking American workers. And then on top of that, Reagan gave amnesty to 3 million people who were here from Mexico illegally, which exploded the flow of people coming into the United States who were willing to work cheap and who could easily be exploited by employers, something very near and dear to the hearts of Republicans. And so the result of this was a recession, or is now recession. A slowing down of economic activity. Our schools are falling apart. Our roads and bridges are falling apart. Our infrastructure basically is in a crisis. It's going to take $1 trillion or more just to rebuild our infrastructure back to where it was in the 1960s. Because we've been giving tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires and borrowing money for wars and spending not a penny on the core stuff. On the stuff that the soil in which business grows, an educated workforce, a strong infrastructure. And so we have this recession coming along, but on top of that, Bush is saying, you know, no, we're not going to end. I mean, this war has lasted longer than World War II. The 50s were rough. This is going to be rougher. And then on top of that, Bush stops publishing M3, he stops publishing how much money he's printing, and the Fed is printing money like crazy. And through the whole thing, Greenspan takes us right into negative interest rates. I mean, do anything to make the Republicans look good. We were at a point during about 4 years ago or so, where you could borrow money, sit on it, pay it back, and because inflation had gone up more than the cost of interest, you'd actually make money in terms of real terms. And the rich were doing it. And this caused the real estate bubble. Well, it's all bursting all at once. And so all around the world, what we're seeing is countries around the world saying, hey, wait a minute, this ain't working. This thing of free trade, it's not actually free trade. It's corporate trade. It's transnational corporate trade. And it's screwing workers all over the world. I got to tell you about Germany right after this break and what's happening there. This thing about the war, that's not working. I want to share with you some thoughts from Martin Luther King about that. And how all this thing is coming about, how it's going to play out, what can be done about it, and then we'll be taking your calls. Stick around, 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative, this is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's no business like oil business, like no business I know. Everything about it is so thrilling. Buying up the Congress, Mr. Quell. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling like when you're drilling that Arctic well. There are no people like oil people. They smile when it does blow. Withholding technology, they won't fall. OPEC's stranglehold on the oil. They only care that they're earning to that fall. So their profits will grow.
21 minutes past the hour. Speaking of which, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when the stock market opens tomorrow. I think the broad expectation is that there's going to be another significant drop. A lot's going to depend on what happens in Europe and Asia overnight. The markets today, of course, closed for Martin Luther King's birthday, which was last week, but today's the official day. But will the oil stocks drop? Will ExxonMobil drop? Will some of the Canadian oil stocks that are traded on the U.S. Stock Exchange or the New York and on the NYSE and the American Stock Exchange drop? What's going to happen to gold, for example, another one? What these numbers, I think, tell us more than just, you know, what's going on with the stock market is what's going on with the economy as a whole. Gold was over $900 a week or so ago. It's down at $864 right now. It's dropped about $40. Now, it only flirted with $900 for a few hours or less than that, but arguably it's down about $30. And the question in my mind is, are we going into a recession or a full-blown depression? Because if we're going into a recession, probably the commodity stocks, the oil stocks, some of the others, you know, copper, the other minerals that are used that reflect, you know, some semblance of international economic activity will probably hold their own, might be going down a little bit, but over the long term will go back up. And the price of gold will probably stay above 850 anyway, and might creep up to $1,000, $1,500, some people are saying as high as $2,000. Its historic high in inflation-adjusted dollars was in the 1980s, and it was around, as I recall, $1,600. It was actually 800 and something at the time, but when you adjust for inflation. So it's going to be really interesting to see tomorrow, because I think what the markets are going to tell us, not necessarily in a single snapshot, but you'll recall back in September, October, and in particular, there was one day in November, and my recollection is it was November 7th, I said, this is the day that we are going, that we have begun what is going to be within the next 18 months, the Great Depression of the first Great Depression of this century. And we'll see. We'll see. And if so, then Robbie Botcher's advice to get out of stocks altogether and get into certificates of deposit, you know, make your money liquid, is wise. If not, I don't know, you know, and again, this isn't a financial advice show, and I don't present myself as a financial expert. But what I am seeing is countries being hollowed out. This was in the Financial Times weekend edition. Read this over breakfast in London. Hugh Williamson in Berlin reporting in the Financial Times. German politicians yesterday declared that they were ditching their Nokia phones. Why? Because the company is moving its factory from Germany to Romania at the cost of 2,000 jobs. Peter Stunbruch, finance minister, accused Nokia, the world's largest mobile phone manufacturer, of caravan capitalism. Many Germans appeared shocked at Nokia's announcement on Tuesday that it's moving its plant from this western city of Bochum. The company has often been praised for keeping Germany's last mobile phone plant long after others shifted production abroad. Christian Dräger of Berlin's DIW Economic Institute said most producers of textiles and consumer electronics have already moved out of Germany to Eastern Europe and elsewhere in the 1990s or before. Nokia's decision is completely understandable. Nokia said labor costs in Romania are only a tenth of those in Germany. The cost gap, again, I'm quoting from the Financial Times here, the cost gap is even bigger than Nokia claims, with average labor costs in Germany in 2006 topping 32 euros, that's about $47 an hour, compared with 2.45 euros in Romania. That would be about $5 an hour. So from $47 an hour to $5, and it's about 10 to 1. Mr. Schmidt said that at times like these, quote, Germans tend to forget that the country is actually a winner from globalization. Yeah, right. As consumers, Germans want cheap mobile phones, but these also come from globalization. Politicians should talk more about these positive aspects, he says. A word comes to mind, but it's not one I can legally say on the radio. This is the same thing that's happening here. The industrial core of Germany and of many other European countries as a result of their joining the European Union is being hollowed out the same way the industrial core of the United States is being hollowed out as a result of our joining NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. Because what these agreements have done, and people in Europe are beginning to figure this out, there's this huge political ruckus going on in Germany now over Nokia moving to Romania. And the law is that, well, you can't stop it now. You signed the agreement. You're part of the EU. You all have a common currency. When we were in London talking to the taxi driver, he said, you know, the biggest problem here is that it used to be you could make a good living as a plumber. Now the plumbers are coming from Poland. You can't stop it. It's like, welcome to the wonderful world of globalism. And we're left doing nothing but exchanging money with each other. And when your entire economy is based on trading money with each other or saying, would you like fries with that, your country is screwed. And I sure hope that the Democratic candidates, I'm hearing language from them that sounds like they get, obviously the Republicans are clueless on this. They're just like Calvin Coolidge. But I think we're moving in the right direction. 27 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270.
364 days, 10 hours, 17 minutes, 50 seconds until George W. Bush voluntarily leaves office. Interesting. It's looking like the missing White House emails. I mean, this is Nixon's tapes on steroid. The ones out of Cheney's office in particular seem to go missing the very day that Congress said, you better start keeping those things. By the way, we're looking into you. All kinds of strange things going on here. Today, the celebration of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King, his actual birthday was last Wednesday, as I recall. In my mind, one of my favorite speeches of his was his speech about why he was opposed to the war in Vietnam. I'd like to play a minute or so of this and then recap for you where we're at with regard to who's winning what in the Democratic presidential primaries. And then we'll pick up your phone calls at 866-303-2270. Dr. Martin Luther King.
The time has come for America to hear the truth about this tragic war. I've chosen to preach about the war in Vietnam today because I agree with Dante that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a period of moral crisis, maintain their neutrality. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. The truth of these words is beyond doubt. But the mission to which they call us is the most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom. There has never been such a monumental dissent during a war by the American people. Polls reveal that almost 15 million Americans explicitly oppose the war in Vietnam. Additional millions cannot bring themselves around to support it. This reveals that millions have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history.
Isn't that brilliant? The mandates of conscience and the reading of history. And he was speaking of the Vietnam War. I mean, how incredibly relevant today. And I wonder how many of our mainstream media, how many of our corporate-owned media, how many of the damn cheerleaders who brought us into this war, who had, instead of people who really understood the consequences, the economic, political, worldwide, geopolitical consequences of war, simply knew how to lead battalions or how to drop bombs, who had the military cheerleaders on their television programs and their radio shows, rather than people who were actually thoughtful about these issues or knew about these issues. I wonder how many of those media, how many of the mainstream media, how many of the 13 corporations who control 95% of everything we see, hear, and read in America will be playing that part of that speech or any part of that speech today on Martin Luther King, on the day we celebrate Martin Luther King's birthday. Here was one of history's greatest Americans, not only because he worked for desegregation and for an end to racial apartheid in the United States and racial hatred in the United States and to heal the United States from the wounds of over 400 years of slavery, not only, but also because on the greatest moral issues of the day, a whole wide variety of them. Keep in mind, the day he was assassinated, he was speaking on behalf of striking janitors about the right to strike. Because on a wide variety of issues,
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King took the moral high ground and spoke out fearlessly. And spoke out honestly. And frankly, I'm seeing that among and hearing that from very, very, very few of our politicians today on both sides. Although I have to say, on the Republican side, it's reached the point of a psychiatric illness, the denial that's going on the Republican side. On the Democratic side, at least we have some people who are speaking out. They're not speaking out certainly yet. I don't think, frankly, anybody in this generation is speaking out with the force and the integrity and the moral certitude and that Dr. Martin Luther King did, frankly, because they aren't speaking in the face of the danger that he did. I mean, look at the danger that he faced just in saying what he said, a danger that ultimately led to his death. I think the last politician to speak like that, frankly, was Robert Kennedy Jr., or no, it was Robert Kennedy Sr., Bobby Kennedy. And he suffered the same fate. He was killed as well. So, anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Let's get into your thoughts here on the day. Leah in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Leah.
Hi. I'm glad you weren't on that British Airways airplane.
You know, that plane landed literally 2 minutes before our plane did. And we walked into the airport, and we were at the customs area. There were probably 50 people. That was it. It was like nobody was there. We couldn't figure it out. It wasn't until we got out of the airport, and the cab driver said, "Oh, you must have missed the plane crash." It's okay. Apparently, he landed at 12:41, and we landed at 12:40 or so. Anyhow,
I thought about you. I literally thought about you. I thought, I wonder if you guys are okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lee.
Anyway, what I called about was actually anger. a rhetorical question would be, why are Democrats settling for candidates who bundle money? You had a caller earlier, and you mentioned that, you know, Obama did, you know, bundle money, and the caller was like, well, you have to do what you have to do.
Yeah.
And,
well, and John Edwards is bundling money as well, by the way. Let's just, you know, be upfront about all of these guys. Although,
yeah, I know, but I mean, why are we? Dennis Kucinich isn't.
Right. Well,
and candidates who have.
As far as we know.
There's candidates out. I haven't heard any of them except Dennis Kucinich. And I like Edwards a lot, but I haven't heard him even talk about it. They've not promised to restore the Constitution. People were calling and yelling about this 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
No torture, no military tribunals, no warrantless eavesdropping. All the candidates are staying away from it. And
I don't, Leah, respectfully, I have heard John Edwards speak to all of those issues. I believe that I've heard Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton speak to, if not all of them, certainly the majority of them.
Well, possibly. However, when I listen to various, I don't listen to any right-wing radio, none, zero, zilch. I put that out 10 years ago and was like, okay, these people are all not my kind of people. However, I am starting to agree with Republicans who say that America is basically a center-right country, because I think Barack Obama is not left. He's not at all. He's center or center-right, and so is Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I'm not entirely disagreeing with you, and I'm saying time will tell, but let's keep in mind, let's always keep in mind, in 1932, Franklin Roosevelt was not elected as the guy who was going to dramatically change America. In fact, to the contrary, he was elected as the guy who was going to reduce the tariffs by about a half a percentage. Anyhow, here's the score, by the way, as for those of you who are keeping score, because there are not winners and losers, although the mainstream media, the corporate media, calls them that. There are actually delegates that are acquired. Hillary Clinton so far has 109 delegates, uncommitted delegates, 55. These are anti-Hillary delegates, basically, who could go to either Barack Obama or John Edwards, should the Michigan delegation be seated. Barack Obama, 38. John Edwards, 18. And so time will tell. We'll see how it all shakes out. Will in Charlotte, Michigan. Hey, Will, we got about a minute before the break. What's up?
Hey, Tom, wanted to get your take on voter ID laws. We've got one that just went into effect in Michigan. They're requiring us to show photo ID at the polls, and I believe it's a violation of the 24th Amendment right to tax-free suffrage.
Yeah, arguably, because a lot of people, like my mother, for example, who doesn't have a driver's license, would have to go out and buy something in order to be able to vote, and therefore, you know, it's a violation. I agree. I am opposed to them. I think the risk, it's a risk-benefit ratio, basically. And the risk of people who are not citizens or who cannot legally vote versus the risk of disenfranchising millions of people because, like my mom, they don't have a driver's license or they're poor enough that they don't have a driver's license, it is just not worth it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Tom Hartman Program.
Now hush. Don't say a word.
Oh, it's the NSA song.
It's enough to know my words are being heard. And we're fighting freedom here at home. So we don't have to fight it over there. Now my own sweet Marie never listens to me, not my brother or even my mama. But when they're on the line, I know you hear me whine. Take that, Osama. Won't you please tell Condoleezza I ordered extra cheese, and I love her.
I love her,
'cause she's out there.
She's out.
Here's
there.
How I know. A stain on a dress, but a leak nonetheless tells me so.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. So NSA, yes. Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Two other quick observations from our trip to the UK. Our weekend 35th wedding anniversary slash business meeting. Part of our business meeting was we met with Sue Nethercutt, who runs our chat room. If you go to tomhartman.com and click chat, you'll get in there. And with Nigel Peacock, who built our first website way back 10 years ago and 6 years ago when we started this program, and still is hosting on his server some of our stuff. And it was great to see Sue and great to see Nigel. But we were also seen by everybody everywhere. The UK is the most observed society in the world. You can't go anywhere. And this was the other thing that every taxi driver we talked to was complaining about, is that all these cameras were installed all over London, ostensibly to stop terrorists. And they all laugh about this when you say stop terrorists, because they say what they're used for is a new tax. If you park in the wrong place, the minute your parking meter goes out, or the minute that you park in the wrong place, or if you stand too long waiting for somebody to show up for a car, for example, or if you any kind of even minor traffic infraction, they take the picture of your license plate and they mail you a ticket for $100 or $200 or whatever, 160 pounds. If you're speeding, if you go in a 35-mile zone, if you go 40 miles per hour, bang, you get a ticket in the mail. And so it's like super Big Brother society over there. The other thing, on the flip side of that, is you would think that Heathrow Airport would be the most hysterical in America, or in the world, because it's where Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, came from. I mean, here in America, I've had so many people complain to me about getting athlete's foot walking through American airports because you have to take your shoes off, as did the 10,000 people in front of you. And particularly in areas where there's carpets, it's impossible to clean all that fungus out of there. Well, in the UK, not only did they not ask us to take our shoes off, everybody wore their shoes. And they did not ask us to take my computer out of the bag. In fact, there was a sign saying you no longer have to take your computer out of your bag. But we weren't even asked to take liquids out of our bags. So Louise had some shampoo and makeup and all that kind of stuff that women carry around with them. I figured out how to travel these days with no liquids whatsoever, but they didn't even ask. Didn't even ask. So, anyway. But here we've got this hysteria, and there, I mean, they've got homegrown terrorism, and they've got, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They've got a long history of dealing with it. So they figured out the difference between hysteria and doing something serious. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steve in Portland, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Steve.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out how badly the free market doesn't work in this country as far as health care goes.
Back to our debate from the first hour?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because, like, in this country, we use 16% of our GDP for health care. Every other industrialized country in the world that has national health care only uses 9 to 11% of their GDP. If the free market was actually working, we'd only be spending like 7%. And what's worse is that they've got better health statistics, better infant mortality, longevity,
right,
and we've got worse.
Yeah, there is no such thing as a free market. Without strict regulation of capitalism, what you have is laissez-faire capitalism, which is a cancerous thing. And we have reached the cancer stage of capitalism here in the United States, again, as we did in 1929. And I think we're going to see similar results. Excellent point, Steve. Thank you for making it. I appreciate it. Steve in Venetia, California.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I've got a comment about the statement you made earlier about the war in Iraq has no profit motive or won't bring.
It has minimal economic long-term benefit to the United States.
Yeah, well, that's not what Cheney and the energy people said during their secret energy policy meeting right after he took office. I have friends that actually work for DOE and passed on this little tidbit. They were estimating that if they were to attack Iraq, take control of Iraq's oil, there would be $1 trillion, that's trillion with a T, dollars, profit, net profit, to the oil companies.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's when oil was $20 a barrel.
Now, plus there was talk about it driving the price of oil down to $15 a barrel.
Yeah. So they intended to make huge sums of profit. They weren't going to share them with us. Much of that trillion net was going to come out of our pockets.
Well, they made the profit anyway. You know, the oil companies are doing very well, thank you very much, with $100 a barrel oil. They're making a fortune. Plus, all of Cheney's buddies are, you know, from Halliburton to Bechtel to on and on, you know, Blackwater, the list goes on and on. A lot of names that you don't recognize quite so easily. They're all making out like bandits, no pun intended, over there. It's frankly a crime. You know, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman was a senator, United States senator during World War II. And he said, let's have a commission to investigate whether anybody's making money on this war. And you would think that somebody seeking to investigate the administration would cause the president, the head of the administration, to be a little upset. It certainly would with George W. Bush. But instead, Franklin Roosevelt said, great idea, you do it. The Truman Commission was put into place. They put people in jail over it. And Harry Truman ended up being nominated as vice president. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. The No Boring Zone. Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. We heard from Dr. Martin Luther King in the last hour, and I pointed out, and I think it's an important one. In fact, it's the lead story up over at commondreams.org. I just noticed just a few minutes ago. That the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King goes beyond simply race. He was an anti-war activist. He was a labor activist. He sought a world of peace, and he sought a world of justice. But there was obviously a very, very large racial dimension to what he was doing, and so many of the ideologues that we've had in this program, and typically the guests that we have in this program are right-wingers that we debate or discuss or argue with or whatever, but so many over the years have said, oh, you guys, you liberals, you just want racial quotas. You want, you know, quotas is their favorite word. Or you want preferential treatment for African-Americans or for fill in the blank, you know, for gays or for, you know, Hispanic, fill in your minority blank. But typically it's African-Americans. And I remember, actually, I don't remember it. I remember Louise telling me about it. In 1983, what was it, 23 years ago, something like that, long ago and far away, we moved from New Hampshire, from Romney, New Hampshire, to Atlanta, Georgia. And we lived in Atlanta for the next decade and a half. I think it was 13 years we lived in Atlanta. And I went down and I looked at some houses, and then Louise flew down to meet with a real estate agent. And when the real estate agent met her, picked her up, her first question to her was, do you want to see mixed neighborhoods or white-only neighborhoods? This was 1983. Now, that question had not been asked of me, but it was asked of my wife, and she was so offended by that that, A, she told that woman that she was offended by it, and, B, she demanded to have another real estate agent show her around the city. And I mean that, but that was Atlanta in 1983, and I would say to some extent that is still Atlanta. I haven't been down there in a few years, but as I said, I lived there 13 years. I lived in the South for 13 years, and I'm not sure it's just Atlanta. The fact of the matter is that although slavery was ended long ago and legal apartheid was ended within my lifetime, in quotes, I say ended in quotes, it's still very much alive. I mean, the stories of black millionaires trying to hail a cab in New York City are legendary and true. The reality is that the wealth gap, not income, not obviously there's an income gap, but the wealth gap between African Americans and Caucasian Americans, white Americans, is huge. $121,000 is the net worth of the average white family in America. Only $19,000 is the net worth of the average black family in America. And most middle-class families' net worth is tied up in their home. And there's a reason for that. Dr. Jonathan Kaplan is with us. He is a professor at Oregon State University. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Glad to have you with you. You specialize in the philosophy of biology, philosophy of science, and political philosophy. And Dr. Kaplan, you and Andrew Valls, a scientist, a political scientist, presumably also a professor there at the university, have put together a study, a survey, as it were. And the headline in today's paper is that you're calling for reparations, which is another word that makes the right wing hysterical. It's not quite what you're calling for. But first of all, could you set up for us the situation?
So what Andrew and I were interested in was the way in which this enormous wealth gap between white Americans and black Americans was created, sort of how that came to be. As you noted, most of that wealth gap comes from owner-occupied housing. So how is it that whites got to build wealth through owner-occupied housing and black Americans were excluded from that?
And this, by the way, I should add, has been largely since the Great Depression and mostly since World War II. Most of, you know, my grandparents never owned a home.
Yep.
You know, it was my father, I think, was the first in his side of the family actually to own property. And that was because he fought in World War II, came back and had the GI Bill.
Exactly. The home ownership as a way of building wealth really wasn't created until the late 1930s, early 1940s, and didn't really take off until, as you noted, after World War II and the GI Bill. And the way that housing became affordable for people was through essentially government subsidies. The government subsidized home loans. They subsidized the insurance for them. They spread out the risk. They created systems that allowed whites for the first time in the history of America to buy houses with very little money down and with very low monthly payments.
Because prior to the 1930s, my understanding is that a typical down payment to buy a house was 50%. And prior to the 1900, in the 18th century and before that, to buy a house, you had to pay cash.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So buying a house before the creation of these low down payment mortgages was essentially making a huge, you know, cash outlay.
Right, you had to be rich, basically.
You had to be rich. People did it towards the end of their lives as a, you know, consumable goods purchase, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the government created a situation in which white Americans could build wealth by buying homes. At the same time, they made it impossible for blacks to do so. Very literally, the FHA housing guidelines stated, I mean, simply came out and stated that mixed neighborhoods were going to be rated very poorly with respect to being able to be insured, and hence that, you know, you, if you were going to have an insurable neighborhood, it had to start white and stay white.
Now, the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives and the Senate throughout the late 40s, from the election of 46, throughout the 50s, as I recall. Was this an act of Congress? Was this presidential? I mean, Harry, you had Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower presidents during that time. Where did this come from?
These were all a series of compromises made at various levels of government. So with respect to the GI Bill, there was no particular rule that said blacks aren't eligible for housing, but to make sure that blacks wouldn't be able to take full advantage of it, the GI Bill had written into it that all the benefits were going to be administered by local boards, and the local boards, of course, were all going to be white and weren't going to want blacks to move into their neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
So it occurred at essentially every level of government. From the federal
so it reflected the systemic racism of American society at the time.
Yes. And it's interesting that, in fact, that systemic racism that you know, because it was government enforced, essentially meant that even individuals who weren't themselves racist were unable to, for example, buy homes in mixed-race neighborhoods because they couldn't get mortgages in mixed-race neighborhoods. Even if you were a white person that wanted to live in a mixed-race neighborhood, if you wanted to buy a home, you couldn't. So this, and because this situation was created in which mixed-race neighborhoods were not going to be eligible for FHA-insured mortgages, essentially what this meant is that even if you weren't a racist, if blacks moved into your neighborhood, you knew that your neighborhood was going to be rated as uninsurable.
So this exacerbated the apartheid that we've seen in the United States, dating back to, I mean, you see what happened with Katrina and that kind of thing, that these black and white neighborhoods, and I don't mean and, I mean these black or white neighborhoods, are the result of this?
In many cases, this actually created that apartheid. I mean,
right.
Before these FHA loans, neighborhoods were, in the North anyway, much more mixed than we currently, than they are now. The racial divide between locations was in large part created by these programs.
Sir, we just have about a minute and a half, 2 minutes here to finish this segment. What remedies can we make to this?
Well, these were government-sponsored programs, and whites were the building of white wealth was subsidized by the government. For those reasons, we think that there have to be government-sponsored remedies. You can't rely on the market to solve these problems. It would take too long, and it's unfair. So what kinds of remedies? Well, there have to be ways to allow black Americans to build wealth in the ways that white Americans were allowed to build
low
wealth.
Low-interest loans for housing.
Very low-interest subsidized loans for housing. Very generous terms for starting up businesses. More money into education. More money into neighborhoods that have been traditionally underrepresented by banks and other sort of wealth-building enterprises.
Right. We're not talking 40 acres and a mule here. We're not talking reparations. We're talking setting the balance straight.
It's interesting that you say not reparations. Not reparations in terms of not actually giving cash handouts to people, perhaps. But these are supposed to be repairing harms that were done. So we think of these as reparations.
In the purest sense of the word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very well said. Dr. Jonathan Kaplan of Oregon State University. Fascinating article. It's on the front page of the Oregonian, OregonLive.com, if you want to read the online version of it. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, great work that you're doing. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
And I wonder, yes, I wonder,
yes, I wonder,
is this the way life's meant to be?
21 minutes past the hour. Today, Martin Luther King Day, the day we celebrate his birthday, which was actually last Wednesday. Let us not forget, as an outspoken critic of the war, as an outspoken defender of labor, he died giving a speech in support of the sanitation workers. The sanitation workers union, their right to unionize, their strike. He died in support of that, giving a speech in support of that. Every week on this program, I'm a labor junkie, I confess. My dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years. One of my brothers is the shop steward for the electricians union in Lansing, Michigan, the other for the printers union in Lansing, or I shouldn't say the, A, you know, for their particular relative companies. Another of my third brother works for the state. He's, the state municipal and employees union. I come from, and I'm a member of two unions, so here, you know, it's a union family. And every week we do a union segment. One of my favorite people to have on is Terry O'Sullivan. Terry is the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org is that union's website. And Terry, welcome to the program.
It's great to be on your show, as always, particularly with a union brother and your history and your family history with organized labor.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you. You sent a note earlier to David, and I thought it was just some great stuff in it here about how in December 49,000 construction workers lost their jobs in 1 month alone. 2007, 195,000 jobs lost. That infrastructure produces a 6-to-1 return on investment. I've been raving about this for the better part of 2.5 hours, by the way, just to put this in context about how when we borrow money or spend money to build bombs and drop them on other people, it produces nothing. But when we borrow or spend existing tax money or borrow against the future, bonds and things like that, and use that money to build infrastructure, it actually produces economic activity and pays for itself many times over.
Yep, without a doubt, Tom. You know, the unemployment rate reached 5% in December. As you said, 49,000 construction workers lost their jobs in that month alone, almost 200,000 for the year 2007. And it's been primarily over the last 12 months in the residential sector. What was alarming with the numbers, the December numbers, was the slide in commercial construction, which had remained relatively stable. We lost almost 17,000 jobs in December in the commercial construction industry.
Jeez. Now, in addition to this, Terry, I was back in Michigan a couple weeks ago, and my brother John, my youngest brother, is the one who's the shop steward for the printers union for one of the larger I'm not going to name the newspaper, but one of the larger newspapers in Michigan. And they're negotiating the contract. And he was telling me the story of sitting across the table from the negotiator, and I'm not talking out of school because he told his members this, and she was suggesting that their health benefits should be cut back and their pension benefits should become essentially optional. And he turned to her and he said, would you do that for your salary? Would you want a job like that? And she shrugged and she said, probably not. In a moment of candor. But I mean, this is the challenge that unionized labor across America is facing, is that these huge transnational corporations are basically just raping the base of labor.
Without a doubt. I mean, it goes back to a lot of the conservative Republicans' view about an ownership society, Tom.
Yeah.
You know, what you make, you keep. People making minimum wage, maybe even a little more than minimum wage. How is it that you can afford health care or retirement security? Is something that they feel they're never going to see. And that's exactly not only union members throughout this country, but working people in general.
Yep.
are falling further behind.
Terry, let me very quickly give you my take on this, and I'd love to hear your take on this take. I don't think that any of these economic stimulus packages, including the ones proposed by the Democrats, are going to do a damn bit of good because they're all short term. What we need is fundamental restructuring of the economy. We need a higher minimum wage, and we need a card check, make it easier to unionize, and we need a redirection of our priorities as a society, and we need to stop all this cheap junk from coming into the United States and our jobs being offshored. Your take on this?
Couldn't agree more. I mean, we need to look short-term, mid-term, and particularly long-term, and I'm with you, Tom. A lot of the proposals that I've seen, while interesting, without going through the merits of all the different proposals, tax cuts for the rich aren't going to stimulate this economy long-term. That's why in the laborers and the construction industry, we certainly hope that one element of this economic stimulus package is going to be increased spending for transportation infrastructure.
Right.
We believe that's a jobs bill. For every $1 billion in construction spending, it creates about 47,000 jobs. We think short-term, mid-term, long-term, those are the kinds of economic stimulus packages that this country needs to be looking at.
But the Republicans say building bombs and making war is fine, but borrowing money or even spending existing money for infrastructure, for highways? Oh, that's got to be socialism.
That's what they say, and that's what we have to overcome. I'm with you. Short-term is not going to do anything for this economy. It's not going to do anything for working people.
Yeah, $500
in my long-term solutions.
Yeah, $500 in my pocket is not going to. In fact, I think most people are just going to use the money to pay off their credit cards.
I think they'll be paying Christmas debt off.
There you go, Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of Labor's International Union of North America, one of the most insightful observers of the labor scene in America. LIUNA.org, the website. Terry, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Always good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
If there's something you find to believe in, then the message must get through. So don't just sit in silence when you know. Turn it up. Turn it up. Make it louder.
34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, get out there and speak up, my friends. Strange stuff going on out there in the world. I'll tell you some downright crazy things here. Poor Jean Mariola. She's a grandmother of 8, 75 years old. Pulls up to McDonald's, orders coffee and French fries. Person says, take just a minute, just stay there at the window. There's a police officer behind her in a cruiser. Impatient, apparently. So he jumps out of his car and he arrests her. He handcuffed her behind her back, put her in the cruiser, searched her, photographed her, and fingerprinted her. Jail records show she was released 90 minutes later on her own recognizance. Oh, my. Poor Jean. And if anything qualifies for a Jaws alert, this is it. This is from a study. This is out of the Independent, yesterday's Independent newspaper I picked up at the airport on the way back. One of the major British newspapers. I'm sure you can find it all over the web by now. Jeffrey Lean, the environmental editor. Radiation from mobile phones produces delays and reduces sleep and causes headaches and confusion, according to a new study. The research, sponsored by the mobile phone companies themselves, shows that the headset before bed causes people to take longer to reach the deeper stages of sleep and to spend less time in them, interfering with the body's ability to repair damage suffered throughout the day. Now, this was not published by some crackpot institution. MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Progress in Electromagnetics Research Symposium, published it, and it was funded by the Mobile Manufacturers Forum, a coalition of mobile manufacturer companies. The research was done by Wayne State University in Michigan and the Karolinska Institute of Sweden, one of the top university research centers in Sweden. The embarrassed mobile phone manufacturers forum played down the results, insisting, at apparent variation with the published conclusion, that the results were inconclusive. But Professor Begnat Artnats, who led the study, said, quote, "We did find an effect from mobile phones from exposure scenario that were realistic. This suggests that they have a measurable effect on the brain." He believes that the radiation may activate the brain's stress system, which is why people have such a hard time sleeping if they've used the mobile phone within the late afternoon or evening hours. Strange stuff. Well, you need to know it, right? 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Ralph in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Ralph, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. By my, both of my parents were members of unions, and both were officers in those unions.
Well,
and
good on them, Ralph.
Well, the thing was, the happiest day of my mother's life was when they paid off the mortgage on the only house they owned, and because that meant that nobody could take it away from her.
Yep, that's right. My dad paid off the mortgage on his house. I remember the last 15 years or so of his life, he used to make jokes about how he had a 3% mortgage, and how the mortgage companies were always pitching him to refinance his house so that they could jack up the interest rates. But he paid that thing off about, I don't know, 5-6 years before he died, and it was a big deal.
You know, the thing that I was, how shall I say, I'm not sure I'm true to my class because I went to law school and became a real estate lawyer. But the short thing that I'm looking at is almost all the proposals that the candidates are coming up with are like voter candy, and you sort of delve into them. And I mean, I'll just give you one example. That's what I told your screener. And I'm not picking on Hillary. It's just look at this one. Is Hillary says she's going to give a 90-day holiday to foreclosures.
Right.
Well, the monetary effect of that is you're taking away the foreclosure rights of the lenders, of the big banks. So that means that the U.S. taxpayers are going to have to pay compensation to those big banks and the lenders and everybody who invested in the derivatives.
Or they're going to have to borrow some more money from China.
Well, that's how we're going to pay it off. But bottom line is the Fifth Amendment says just compensation for a taking of property.
You're right. The Constitution would require us to back up those folks.
Absolutely. And so what you have...
Well, although, you know, in Hillary's defense, or I'm not sure if this is a defense, it may be a damnation, but she's suggesting that this be a voluntary program.
Well, but the problem...
And a voluntary program might prevent the triggering of the Fifth Amendment, and it might also cause all the banks to say, yeah, right, sure.
Exactly. Being an old real estate lawyer in a falling market, and I participated in more ways than one in the Resolution Trust Corporation. But the short of it is, in a falling market, what you're doing is you're preventing a lender from foreclosing today when he might get a decent price, and you're forcing him 90 days from now to get a worse price.
Yep.
And he's going to take it right out of the taxpayer's hide.
That's right. You know what this reminds me of, Ralph, is the PR stunt that John Rockefeller's PR advisor suggested he do in the late 20s, early 30s, as I recall, which is to go out on the street and hand out shiny new dimes. Remember that?
No.
I mean, neither one of us are old enough to remember it, but
no.
it's a legendary story about John Rockefeller that he used to go out on the street. He did this for a couple of weeks, and it just got massive nationwide press. He'd go out there with a roll of dimes, and back then a dime was worth today maybe, you know, $2 or $3. I mean, it was not an insignificant amount of money that he was passing out. He was passing out, you know, a day's worth of food, basically, to people. And he'd go out on the street, and he'd just hand out dimes to people and get mobbed, you know, mostly by kids, but, you know, he'd be mobbed by people. And it was, you know, John Rockefeller, what a philanthropist, what a wonderful guy. And that, in my opinion, is what all of the Democratic candidates are at least what Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, to a large extent, are proposing. John Edwards is talking about some serious structural change, but increasingly it's looking like he may well play the role of a kingmaker at the Constitution. He may be able to force a more progressive party platform. He may be pushing these candidates. Well, actually, I don't want to write anybody out. We have to wait and see what happens.
Just one other thing.
Yeah.
Barney Sanders has touched on it.
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. But when I started practicing law, homeowners, my mother, your dad, were protected by usury laws and by basically a bankruptcy-friendly law that allowed you to keep your house.
Yeah, the usury laws went away under the Nixon administration.
Exactly. And the thing is, that's gone now.
Yep.
And
the bankruptcy laws went away in the last 5 years.
Well, the thing that we need to do is remember those laws came from the Big Depression to protect the small people.
Yep.
We need them back again.
I agree.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, and thanks for the call, Ralph. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We need them back again. We're not going to get them back, and I don't think we're not going to get them out of this Congress. I mean, the Republicans will filibuster them in the Senate, and you know whether the Democrats will bring them forth in the House. And obviously, even if it should magically make it all the way to the White House, Bush would veto these things. Dick in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Dick.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, buddy?
Just fine. What's
Happy.
Up?
I just want to salute a great leader, Martin Luther King, about the dream. And I want to say about your book, I try to use the principle about, you know, democracy is for the people, by the people. We don't want this corporate image to take over. I just think it's a great book, Tommy.
Thank you very much, Dick. I appreciate the call. Virginia in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Virginia.
Tom, Amy Goodman ran a big chunk of Martin Luther King's Riverside Church speech this morning, and then she commented, she quoted from Time Magazine and Washington Post their reactions, and they were hateful.
Their reactions at the time.
Their reactions at the time.
They because he came out against the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
He was vilified.
Yeah.
Hoover was following him around as a commie.
Exactly.
I mean, you had people on the floor of the House of Representatives and the Senate calling him a communist for supporting the Vietnamese and hurting our troops and all this kind of stuff.
So one of the things I want to say to the listeners who are concerned about the current state of media is it has always been such. It is more concentrated, but it has always served the ruling class. I also want to say that the social Darwinists have had it their way for all of recorded history. We've gotten power and privilege for a few. We've gotten perpetual war, poverty, disease, racism, sexism. I think after thousands and thousands of years, we should try something different.
Yeah. The Jubilee. Yeah. You go back and read in the Old Testament about the Jubilee. You know, every 50th year, every 49 years plus one. All the slaves were freed, all income was equalized, all debts were forgiven, and basically society rebooted itself. And I think it's just an absolutely great idea, and there are actually some economists out there who are saying we should consider a jubilee. And I don't think it's such a bad idea, frankly. Dave in Hollywood, California. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Tom. Congratulations to you and Louise on your anniversary.
Thank you.
I just want to say I had a question. Why, in light of the Benazir Bhutto David Frost interview and the fact that two planes don't knock down three buildings, what are we doing in Afghanistan? And do the candidates ever talk about getting out of Afghanistan?
No.
Okay.
No, they don't. Because conventional wisdom is that Afghanistan was a good war. I was opposed to bombing Afghanistan. I thought it was nuts. The Taliban was offering to give us Osama bin Laden, well, not us, but some third-party nation for a trial. We should have said, fine, let's have a trial. Let's have this thing done with. Let's deal with Osama bin Laden the way we dealt with Tim McVeigh. The guy's a criminal. Let's put him in jail. But no, George had to have a war. And somehow the media, the whole story, from the corporate media in the United States to the politicians in the United States, the vast majority of the politicians in the United States think invading Afghanistan was just a fine idea. Thank you very much. They've never watched Lawrence of Arabia. They've never bothered to read the history of the time. They don't get it. You don't invade and occupy Afghanistan. It doesn't happen. It ain't never happened before. It ain't never going to happen again. It's not going to be successful. It's going to be a disaster. And the problems that we're having in Iraq right now, we're going to be having in Afghanistan 4 or 5 years down the road. Although to a large extent, more than half the country, we're already having that problem right now. I'm talking about Kabul. It's absolutely nuts. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman Program. The True People's Radio.
Tom Hartman.
It's the family that grieves for a lost loved one. It's the soldier who won't leave till the job is done. It's the addict trying to turn his life around. It's picking yourself up off the ground when you've been knocked down. We carry on.
Indeed we do. Despair is not an option, my friends. No matter how much it may seem that the cons own the world, we will take back, if not all of it, a good piece of it. Our voice will be heard. The Tom Hartman Program, by the way, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, helping the voice be heard and fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Craig in San Jose, California. Hey, Craig, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
Happy Martin Luther King Day. I just had a question about. I'm having a hard time understanding how Edwards did so poorly in the caucuses when the polls before the caucuses showed, you know, like a statistical dead heat.
Well, the way caucuses work is you get a bunch of people together and they kind of basically argue about what's going to work and what isn't going to work. And once a consensus is reached among that group, they kind of all move as a herd in that direction. You know, so you tend to have a few big winners and a whole lot of small losers. And
it's sort of like instant runoff voting.
Well, yeah, actually, it's probably the best comparison, you know, and you combine that with the fact that John Edwards had written off Nevada. He didn't advertise in it, he didn't spend any money there, and he only visited once, I think. And so,
yeah, but in spite of that, he had very good poll numbers. So I was just surprised that he did so poorly.
There's also, I've heard that there's been some push polling because back, you know, 10, 12 years ago when he was a senator, he had voted in favor of the Yucca Mountain. He has since said, you know, the science has changed. His opinion has changed. He thinks it was a terrible mistake. But that there have been push polls where people have been calling saying, hey, did you know that, you know, et cetera. And certainly, even without the push polls, the both the other two candidates brought it up at the last debate. That didn't help. That didn't help him any at all.
Sure.
So, but, you know, I just don't know, Craig. I mean, I wasn't there. We've heard from a few people who were there, and it's, you know, really interesting to hear their take on it. But thank you for the call. I do appreciate it. Jody in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Jody.
Hello.
Jody, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling in regards to the corporate media, and especially how, in regards to its treatment of John Edwards, and how I think that the radio talk shows that I've been listening to have fed that as well, just by talking more about the polling and how people are doing, versus talking about some of the issues where John Edwards truly shines.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Jody, and I would add two more names to that. I'd say that that's also true of Ron Paul, and it's also true of Dennis Kucinich. And the reason why is because all three of them are promoting a message. Ron Paul, to a lesser extent, he actually, the big transnational corporations would do very well with Ron Paul as a president, but they, you know, but he says many things that they don't like let's get out of Iraq. But by and large, Dennis Kucinich, Ron Paul, and John Edwards, all three of them are not the friends of the huge, you know, this handful, this between 6 and 13 corporations that control over 90% of what everybody in America sees, hears, and reads outside of the Internet. And for that reason, you're spot on right. You're absolutely right. And the message is just not getting out. I think it's a crime. Andrew in Seattle. Hey, Andrew.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hey, okay. So I since 9/11, I've watched all the talking head political shows on Sunday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
Just to try to keep up. And yesterday, you know, I got up to do my morning ritual with the coffee, and not one of those shows in Seattle was on. Not a single political talking head show. And since 9/11, I've never missed them, and not one of them were on. There was infomercials on instead.
Oh, that's strange.
Yeah, and I don't know if there was news that was coming out that, like, maybe...
No, if it's infomercials, it means that you've got a TV station that figures they can make more money on the infomercial than they can selling advertising on the show. But that's downright strange. Andrew, I don't have any idea what's going on in Seattle. I'll tell you, they were on the air here in Portland because Louise and I recorded them on our contraption and watched them last night. I mean, that's for 19, 20 years we didn't have a television. All the years we were raising kids, but when we started this show, we had got to know what's going on. And so last night we watched Meet the Press, as I recall. Anyway, I'm not sure that we saw the other one, Face the Nation. Doug in Staten Island. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind today? Thanks for listening to WWRL, by the way.
How are you doing, Tom?
Just great.
Tom, listen, I was wondering if you there's a story coming out of the South China Morning Post out of Hong Kong, which basically says that even though they thought the Asian banks were going to be insulated, that that the Bank of China, the biggest one, has at least $8 billion that it's unaccounted for. And the ICBC, which is a construction bank, basically has some sort of problem with the subprime mortgage because they're invested heavily in the U.S. securities.
Oh, geez.
So what's that going to do with us being able to continue to borrow money from them?
Well, a few billion dollars is nothing. I mean, they're sitting on $600 billion just of our debt. We have a $600 billion a year trade deficit with the rest of the world, about $250 billion. That's with China. So broadly, you know, macros in the largest macro sense is probably not a big deal. But in the micro sense, if one of these Chinese banks fails, particularly if they're holding, and Doug, I'm sorry, the echo is just making me crazy here, but you can hear it on the radio. In the micro sense, if one of these banks fails, it's going to be the kind of news that shakes people's confidence, and shakes people's confidence is the kind of thing that brings about a depression. Dale in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Hey, Dale, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm real glad to hear your description of Martin Luther King. He kind of fleshed him out as not being just about being there for black people, but being there for really a sense of fair play and decency for all. Mm-hmm. What I'm really calling about is in relation to your previous guest who was talking about segregation.
Yeah. Dale, I'm really sorry. We're out of time. But I appreciate the call and your kind words. Maybe we can pick it up tomorrow. Tomorrow I'll be debating conservative David Frum on his new book, Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Oh, yeah. Jeffrey Kleinman with DVD Talk, the Democratic debate tonight, and your calls. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.